I'm Jeremy Hobson. I'm the host of Here and Now on NPR, which is produced here at WBUR in Boston and around the country. And we're here today for Perilous Journeys. We've got three terrific authors here, and I'm going to introduce them in a moment. We're going to speak for probably 45 minutes or so, and then if you guys have any questions, we can take some of those as well at the end. This is Carl Hoffman, whose book is Savage Harvest. Vicky Croak, Elephant Company is her book, and Scott Anderson, Lawrence in Arabia. Thank you all so much for being here. And I thought I would start, because these perilous journeys that we're talking about are so different from each other, and just give you a few minutes to tell a little bit of the story of what happens in your book. And by the way, these are all nonfiction. We'll start with Carl.
Thanks. Everybody hear me all right? So Savage Harvest is a story about the son of one of the richest and most powerful men in the world vanishing in a swamp. Except he didn't vanish, he was killed and eaten. And he wasn't just killed and eaten in a random sort of Hollywood B-movie way, but to make the world right, to rebalance it, to reclaim a people's vanishing power, nourish a community. His death brought life into this community, and it was a very sacred act. And in fact, it wasn't a mystery at all. The Dutch, he disappeared in the southwest coast of what was then Netherlands, New Guinea, and within about 3 weeks of his disappearance, both the government of the Netherlands and the Catholic Church were fully aware of his disappearance, and they had known about it. So it really hasn't been a mystery for 50 years. It's been a mystery to the Rockefeller family and to the rest of us. And to discover all this, there were two pieces of the puzzle, and one was archival. I spent about a year and a half with a researcher, a Dutch-speaking researcher, going deep into the archives of the Dutch government and the Catholic Church. And we found hundreds of pages of documents that had never been seen before, including these, and all of the documents were amazing. I mean, these letters on letterhead from the apostolic vicar, the highest Catholic Church official in Dutch New Guinea at the time, saying, this is a cabinet of glass. If you find out anything more, put it in a double envelope marked secret only to me. Never speak of this to the Rockefellers or to the press. And the other part of it was going deep into Asmat, into this place that's 10,000, even today it's 10,000 square miles of roadless swamp. There's not a car in it. There is one cell tower, one grass airstrip, and the village in which Michael, that was reported originally to have killed Michael, a village called Ochinep, even today there are no stores, no electricity, no plumbing. All the sons of the men named in the original reports as having killed Michael are still living there and well. And much of the book is an attempt to understand this place, this wild people. And I made two trips into Asmat of 2 months each. And the first was, it took me 9 days to get there from Washington, D.C., and there were a lot of logistical challenges involved. They had to find a translator, they had to find a guy with a boat. The guy with the boat had to get an assistant. The translator had to get an assistant. Eventually, I had to get a translator for my translator because he didn't speak English very well. And it's a long story. That's what the book's about. But we made it to the village of Ochinep. I actually went in twice during my first 2 months there. And Ochinep was a place like no other, and it made the hair on the, if I'd been a dog, you know, my hair would have stood up. And I was sort of greeted with a wall of silence after a little while there. It was a very intimidating place, difficult to be there. And I really, I got very little out of it, and I went home and started writing and sort of stomping my feet. And 7 months later, I returned. I decided I had to go back and that I had done everything all wrong and that I had violated all the laws of journalism and that I'd gone in too fast, and I hadn't spent enough time, and I'd been relying on all these other people, this whole entourage, and that I didn't know what people were telling me and what if what I was asking was being translated. So I found a teacher of Bahasa Indonesia, which everybody speaks in Azmat now. It's now part of Indonesia. And I learned Indonesian and returned to the village, and I returned alone without anybody, without any translators. And the boatman, Willem, brought me in, and I had a satellite phone, and I asked him to just come back in a month if he hadn't heard from me. And when that boat went away, I was nervous, and I sort of couldn't believe what I was doing. The last American priest in Azmat, who had been there for 37 years, told me it would be the hardest month of my life.
Well, and by the way, this is a book about, you're going there to write a book about somebody who did this journey and died.
That's correct. So anyway, I'm finishing up. It's long-winded. But anyway, so I stayed in that, and everything was different coming back and speaking the language, even though I didn't speak it very well, and I learned a lot more as time went along. But all the men, you know, these people who wouldn't really speak to me all came around, all the old men. I brought cases of tobacco. Everybody smokes there. Everything, every exchange is greased over tobacco. And we sat down, and they patted me on the shoulder, and we rolled cigarettes, and they took me under their wing, and that changed everything. It was a completely different experience, and it was only when I sort of gave myself over to the village that all the strands of this, what is actually a really complex and rich story, came together. And I was lucky because while they were building a new JEU, a new men's house. They're about 120 feet long and spectacular structures. And so it just, and there was a lot of celebrating and feasting going on there. So I'll just read a very, very short passage. They broke just before sunset, then resumed outside on the boardwalk at 8 p.m. The moon was only a sliver. It was so dark I couldn't see my feet, but a fire burned on a bed of mud on the boardwalk, and cigarettes glowed, and vast number of stars cut the blackness overhead, the Milky Way thick, heat lightning rolling across the horizon. At first there were five or six drummers and a handful of men, but a voice called into the darkness, booming, echoing, half song, half call, and soon 100 had gathered. The drums cut through the night, and the deep chanting songs called forth the spirits. Kokai had told me they were a bridge to their ancestors, and the men of Pirion rocked the boardwalk. Spirits were here, swirling around us in the dark. I couldn't see them, but they were here, as surely as the mosquitoes and lizards and crickets filling the night. The air reverberated. The men, their deep voices, the beat of the drums, their imaginations, and the images that appeared to them were as much a part of the jungle as the insects and the lightning and the moist air and the trees and the river a few yards away. It was all gathered in one consciousness. You couldn't separate any of it out. The drums and voices knitted it all into a wholeness that stretched back years, generations, maybe centuries and even millennia. And I couldn't help it. I imagined Michael's spirit among them, swirling overhead in the jungle night, threading through the palms, the stars, a ghost who is finally free. Around midnight, women began streaming in, bearing huge bowls of rice, piles of pale yams, sago, even two bowls of green vegetables. The men divided them into five piles, one for each section of Pirion, and ate. Biff placed placed a pile by me. "For Kokai," he said. It was a huge moment of respect and acceptance. I was Kokai's representative. Their stamina was amazing. Without alcohol or drugs, they went on, and around three I finally collapsed, climbing over and around the sleeping bodies of women and children when I got to Kokai's house, and falling asleep, fast asleep, to the rhythmic voices echoing through the darkness and over the swamp. Thank you.
And by the way, how many of you remember the disappearance of Michael Rockefeller, the story of that? Wow. All right. So we're going to move on here. Reverse chronologically to Vicky.
My book is Elephant Company, which is about James Howard Williams. He's a real animal lover who had seen brutal and horrific war in World War I, terrible fighting, and he wanted to retreat from Western civilization. And in 1920, about the best place to do that was Burma. It was as exotic as it came for an Englishman. And what lured him there was the promise of elephants. He'd always loved all kinds of animals, and He had never met an elephant before, but as soon as he got to...
Vicky's the one that's on the radio regularly. You'd think she would know.
Do I not wear an earring on radio? Anyway, so James Howard Williams comes to Burma. He falls in love with elephants. In fact, he would later say that he learned more about courage and about being a good man from elephants than he ever did from another human being. When he got there, he worked for a logging company that followed a tradition that was thousands of years old, and they would break elephants in order to get them into captivity and to work in the logging business. And he thought, I have to change this. And fortunately, he met a Burmese man named Potok, who had worked on gentling elephants rather than breaking them. And so together, they worked to make life better for elephants, to make captivity better for them. He made an elephant school and an elephant hospital in Burma. And when World War II broke out, he led the only company of elephants in World War II for the Allied forces. Elephants were really sought after in World War II by both sides, the Japanese and the Allied forces. And they were also legitimate targets for aircraft. But Williams was able to gather behind enemy lines 1,600 elephants by war's end, who provided not only supplies, but they built bridges. They built old-fashioned elephant bridges, which made a big difference in winning the war for the Allied forces in Burma. And I don't know if I should read something or not right now.
Sure, yeah, why don't you read a little bit?
I think it's so funny that you said I'm the one on the radio. I feel inadequate on the radio, too. This is just the beginning of the book. Deep in the jungle-clad hills of northwest Burma, close to the border of the Indian state of Manipur, Billy Williams, delirious with fever, began to regain consciousness. Half dreaming, he scrambled to piece together what was happening. His lanky body felt cockeyed and unresponsive. Even opening his eyes seemed impossible. As hallucination gave way to reality, he remembered his predicament. He was stranded in an inaccessible forest on the wrong side of the raging Yu River, during the dangerous, unrelenting monsoon rains of 1927, and he had never been sicker. His spiking fever was accompanied by chills. The lymph nodes at his groin were swollen to the size of fists, and some of the small pustules lining his feet and legs had broken open. For days, he had been unable to eat and could barely drink. That morning, he could not even stand. As the lashing rains tore at his clothes, he suddenly felt something that he couldn't make sense of. His cot was lurching, as if it was trying to buck him off. Forcing his eyes open, Williams realized he was not on the wrong side of the river, but smack in the middle of it, riding an elephant through the churning avalanche of water. Around him, deadly 2-ton tree trunks shot down the rapids like missiles, crashing into one another with a sound like thunder. Blinking against the pouring rain, he seized the rail of the large bamboo cargo basket, or ka. He lay in as it rocked him back and forth, perilously close to the frothing current. The elephant was pitched at a steep angle, leaning his flank into the wall of water, shouldering all his weight against the chocolate-colored torrent in an effort to keep his footing. Yet Williams felt oddly lucky. That was because of the elephant he rode. There was no way Williams could mistake the animal's identity, even in his feverish state, slumped high up in the basket. The broad expanse of the gray back, the delicate pink freckling bordering the ears, and the rakish slant of the gleaming white tusks, their tips just visible from this viewpoint. This was the only elephant who could brave the crossing, the strongest and most stout-hearted creature in the forest, the best friend Williams ever had, Bandula.
Scott.
I've been a foreign correspondent for... coming on 25 years now, and mostly covering war around the world. And if you cover war in the modern era, you invariably spend a lot of time in the Middle East. Over the years of being in the Middle East, one thing I discovered was that whenever I'd have a really detailed conversation with someone, it didn't matter their political or their religious background, invariably people would trace the roots of the problems today to the peace that was imposed on the region at the end of World War I. So it was always in the back of my mind that, because I really didn't know much about that history, it was always in my back of my mind that one day I'd get off the streets for a while and work on a book about that period. And one thing that kind of sweetened the deal for me was that I knew that that a figure who played a central role in that history was T.E. Lawrence, better known as Lawrence of Arabia. I'd seen the David Lane movie as a kid, and I'd always been fascinated by the figure of Lawrence. So about 6 years ago, I decided to do a book on that period of history, and specifically on Lawrence of Arabia. But when I came up with the idea, the first obstacle that immediately presented itself was, what could I say that was in any way new? Over the years, there have been something like 70 to 80 biographies done on Lawrence. There have been 3 movies, thousands of articles. And the answer came to me by kind of going back to what I think is the core riddle about Lawrence, which essentially is, how did he do it? How did a 28-year-old Oxford scholar, without a single day of military training, painfully shy, 5'4", how did that guy go off to Arabia and become the battlefield commander of an Arab rebel army? Not just an Arab rebel army, but an Arab Muslim army. And the answer that I finally figured out was, I mean, along with the touch of genius and of a man being born to his unique moment in time, part of the answer was that no one was really paying very much attention. The war in Arabia came in the midst of World War I. For the British, the vast majority of their blood and treasure was being expended on the Western Front. So if this eccentric Oxford scholar could go off to Arabia and cause problems for the Turkish enemy, the Turks being allied with the Germans in the war, then he had tremendous freedom of movement to do so. And when I realized about Lawrence, it occurred to me, well, if that was true about the Brits, who were by far the biggest imperial players in the region, then it must have been true about the other warring factions. And so once I came up with that idea, I started looking around and looking at archives, and ended up finding 3 other men. An American who was the only American field intelligence officer in the Middle East during World War I, a German spy who was an Oriental scholar, a very similar bio to Lawrence, and a Jewish settler who was an agronomist who set up a spy ring for the British in Palestine. And what all these men shared was certainly a touch of genius, but a talent for treachery, men who really kind of created, to a large degree, kind of created the Middle East we know today. But amidst all that, the title of my book is Lawrence in Arabia, and there's a reason beyond just the name recognition factor why Lawrence is at the center of the book, and the other ones are satellites around his character. The British were by far the biggest warriors in the region, the warring faction in the region, and they imposed the peace in the aftermath, and a peace that was has proven to be quite disastrous. And Lawrence was intimately connected with both the war and in trying to forestall the peace that was imposed on the region in its aftermath. I'm just going to read a very short section of from the very beginning of the book, and it's right towards the end of the war when Lawrence comes back to London. On the morning of October 30th, 1918, Colonel Thomas Edward Lawrence received a summons to Buckingham Palace. The king had requested his presence. The collective mood in London that day was euphoric. For the past 4 years and 3 months, Great Britain and much of the rest of the world had been consumed by the bloodiest conflict in recorded history, one that had claimed the lives of some 16 million people across 3 continents. Now, with a speed that scarcely could have been imagined mere weeks earlier, it was all coming to an end. On that same day, one of Great Britain's 3 principal foes, the Ottoman Empire, was accepting peace terms, and the remaining 2, Germany and Austria-Hungary, would shortly follow suit. Colonel Lawrence's contribution to that war effort had been in its Middle Eastern theater, and he too was caught quite off guard by its rapid close. At the beginning of that month, he had still been in the field assisting in the capture of Damascus, an event that heralded the collapse of the Ottoman army. Back in England for less than a week, he was already consulting with those senior British statesmen and generals tasked with mapping out the post-war borders of the Middle East. Lawrence was apparently under the impression that his audience with King George V that morning was to discuss those ongoing deliberations. He was mistaken. Once at the palace, the 30-year-old colonel was ushered into a ballroom where, flanked by a half dozen dignitaries and a coterie of costumed courtiers, the king and queen soon entered. A low cushioned stool had been placed just before the king's raised dais, while to the monarch's immediate right, the Lord Chamberlain held a velvet pillow on which an array of medals rested. After introductions were made, George V fixed his guest with a smile and said, "I have some presents for you." As a student of British history, Colonel Lawrence knew precisely what was about to occur. The pedestal was an investiture stool upon which he was to kneel as the king performed the elaborate centuries-old ceremony that would make him a knight commander of the British Empire. It was a moment T. Lawrence had long dreamed of. As a boy, he was obsessed with medieval history and the tales of King Arthur's court, and his greatest ambition, he once wrote, was to be knighted by the age of 30. On that morning, his youthful aspiration was about to be fulfilled. A couple of details added to the honor. Over the past 4 years, King George had given out so many commendations and medals to his nation's soldiers that even knighthoods were now generally bestowed en masse. In the autumn of 1918, a private investiture like Lawrence's was practically unheard of. Also unusual was the presence of Queen Mary. She normally eschewed these sorts of ceremonies, but she had been so stirred by the accounts of T.E. Lawrence's wartime deeds as to make an exception in his case. Except Lawrence didn't kneel. Instead, just as the ceremony got underway, he quietly informed the king that he was refusing the honor. There followed a moment of confusion. Over the 900-year history of the monarchy, the refusal of knighthood was such an extraordinary event that there was simply no protocol for how to handle it. Eventually, King George returned to the Lord Chamberlain's pillow the medal he had been awkwardly holding, and under the baleful gaze of a furious Queen Mary, Colonel Lawrence turned and walked away.
I want to pick up on that because I want to ask you all, what was it about these characters that fascinated you so much enough to spend a very long time looking into and getting this unbelievable detail about their lives? And I'll start with you. Yeah.
What was always fascinating to me about Lawrence, and I think the David Lane movie captures some of it, is he really was this Shakespearean figure. The reason he refuses the knighthood is because he knows that the Arabs were going to be betrayed. They got the Arabs to fight on the British side with a promise of sweeping Arab independence for most of the Middle East. The British then turned around and cut a secret deal with the French, dividing the region into imperial spheres. And throughout the time that Lawrence was fighting in Arabia and enlisting Arabs to fight for the cause, he knew that the odds were, and he tried mightily to subvert the secret English-French pact. But he knew that at the end of the day, they were probably going to be betrayed. So he was incredibly torn. He was a man of dual loyalties, and to the point where in his memoir about the war, he calls himself a fraud and a charlatan. And it's clear he, towards the end of the war, he was just trying to get himself killed. He would lead these suicidal attacks against the Turks. So from a psychological standpoint, I was always fascinated by this figure who seems so tortured and yet also so wise about the Middle East. And his warnings are so resonant today. So much of what Lawrence predicted was going to happen by trying to colonize the region have completely played out. And also just that he's a very mysterious, very enigmatic figure. It's very hard to pin T.E. Lawrence down.
Yeah. Vicki, what about Williams?
First, I want to ask how tall Peter O'Toole is.
Peter O'Toole is 6'4", so there's a foot height difference between them.
What drew me to Williams is simple. I'm an animal lover, and I'm always fascinated by someone who has a mystical or magical connection with animals. And Williams, he lived his life with elephants in the forest, and he recorded behaviors in elephants that our scientists wouldn't validate for decades. He thought that they had some awareness of death, that they would help one another, that they were loyal, and that he witnessed their courage. He saw them using tools, which is something we didn't report for many decades later. And so through the stories he told, we get to see scientific discovery and the remarkable stories of the relationships that he had with elephants. One of my favorite being that one of the elephants who worked in the logging camp went blind, a female. She had a 5-year-old baby who immediately became her guide elephant. And William saw the mother stake her trunk along the baby's back, and he would, instead of playing with the other babies, he would lead his mother to food or wherever she needed to go. And at that time, they wouldn't, the mahouts or uzis as they were in Burma, wouldn't name the elephants until they were 5 years old, until they could see their character. And so he became Guide Man, was this little elephant's name. And a sense of humor, he thought Bandula, which was his best friend, elephant. Many people reported that Bandula was this magnificent tusker. And Bandula was famous for, he could move any log. And what they would do in the teak business in Burma is they would, the elephants would push or pull all of the teak logs down to a dormant river or creek and pile up the logs there. And when monsoon came, they would be taken away by the rain. So Bandula would carry a particularly heavy log just to the precipice, and then he would pretend he couldn't move it any further. And he would mime pushing it with his shoulder and using his trunk, and his mahout would say to him, "Bandula, stop fooling around, you know, push the log." And when the mahouts became really impatient, he would finally just flick it almost effortlessly with his trunk. And then everyone who worked with Bandula swore he would laugh afterward.
But on Williams, when did you first learn about him?
I wrote a book called The Lady and the Panda, which came out in 2005 and was about a dress designer and socialite who brought the first giant panda back to the States in 1936. And I so loved working on that book. I wanted to find something like that. And it took me a long time to discover J.H. Williams. I received a book in the mail about elephants one day, and I was having lunch, and I was flipping through, and there was a little illustration deep in the book of an elephant high up on a cliff overlooking the forest. And it said, J.H. Williams leads a group of refugees from war-torn Burma in 1942. They had the date wrong. But I was so intrigued by that caption, and I wanted to know more about him. And that's how I got onto him.
Carl, as you saw there, a number of people remembered this case about Michael Rockefeller, but what led you to spend so long looking into what happened?
Well, I think Michael was 23 when he set off for New Guinea. He had just graduated from Harvard, and I was 23 when I first slung a backpack on, and Michael and I are from extraordinarily different family backgrounds. But I think his interest in the world and his curiosity and his hunger to see it for himself resonated with me. And then I spent my whole career as a journalist has been on traveling to some of the world's more distant places, and I was always haunted by the idea of, every time I go away, even now, I feel, I have 3 children, and I always think, what if I don't come back? What if something happens to me this
because
time?
Because of this?
No, period. And it's not something that worries me so much that I don't go, but I always think about it, and I'm always haunted by the idea of, how terrible it would be to go, especially to some remote place, and to disappear, to vanish, and not to have anyone know where you are. And I think when things disappear, it's really unsettling to us as human beings to have no answers. On top of that, I had done, my experience really in the world was that as screwed up as the world was and so many weird places, it was also a pretty benign place in a lot of ways. And I wrote a book that came out a few years ago called The Lunatic Express about traveling around the world in the world's most dangerous buses, boats, trains, and planes. But it was really about traveling around the world with and sort of crummy transportation with poor people. And, everywhere I went, sort of a sub-theme of the book, in a way, is how many commonalities we have and how even in really crazy places, people took me in and were wonderful to me. And Savage Harvest is, in many ways, a kind of the flip side of that, you know, I had a sense when I started thinking about Michael and I looked into some of the rumors that if he hadn't just drowned, as the official story said, you know, if he'd been murdered, that something had happened, something very specific. There was a very specific story there. And, you know, it had to be a story that was related to a deep cultural misunderstanding and a gulf, which in fact, in part, it was. And that interested me because I knew in some ways that this "we're all one big happy family" thing that I had out of Lunatic was partly true, but that there was this whole other side, you know, and I came out of my experience in Asmat feeling that, you know, the Asmat, for instance, are privy to this whole world. I mean, that's in part why I read the part that I did, are privy to this sacred spiritual world that lives in their imagination, but it's real for them. And for me, doesn't matter how long I spend there, there's no door, there's no window that I can go through that doesn't exist, that I can go through to enter their world. But their world, and I can say that, oh, my, you know, that's all in their heads, it's all in their imaginations, but it doesn't matter, it's real for them.
Well, and that's clearly one of the reasons why this has remained such a mystery for so long, is that when people ask them questions about what happened, they don't talk about this.
Well, and it's incredibly complicated, you know, and it goes to the core of their whole spiritual life and their whole way they see the world. And, you know, in the end, I felt like the Asmat were, and that many, especially tribal people, you know, live in worlds that are, and live in dimensions, maybe is another word, or have dimensions available to them that are very different from ours. And that made me feel kind of optimistic in a homogenizing world, actually.
One of the things that I noticed in reading all of these books is you read these very vivid descriptions of conversations that happened a long time ago, and I'm wondering how much of that is something that you really know that that's what was said, and how much of it you're just, based on the other things that you do know, you're writing down what you think might have happened there. I did notice, I actually wrote this down, Scott, that you acknowledge at the end of your book in the acknowledgments, Howard Diamond at NOAA, the National Ocean, whatever it is, for pinpointing when a sandstorm struck Beersheba in early January 1914.
Right. Yeah, I became a bit obsessive, I think, when it came to research. I really wanted to know. There was this date, and this was just immediately prior to the war, where Lawrence, who's on kind of a spying mission for the British government, runs into William Yale, my American character, out in the desert, and Yale is pretending to, what they call them playboys back then, they're men of leisure. He pretended to be on this biblical tour of the Holy Land, and yet he was actually with Standard Oil looking for oil out in the desert. So these two men, both with like hidden agendas, meet out in the desert. And in Yale's memoir, he talks about there being this driving sandstorm, and that's how Lawrence was actually able to find his camp, because he got stranded out in the desert, and Lawrence arrived the next day. But he didn't have a date, and I really wanted to pinpoint the date. So, and I tried so many different ways, and I finally went to NOAA because I can't really remember what the acronym stands for either. And they just, this
National
Howard Diamond,
Oceanographic and Atmospheric Administration.
That's right. And he just became obsessed with finding out the date also, this Howard Diamond. And he had a whole team of scientists at NOAA that spent several days going back and being able to pinpoint when this Scirocco hit in this part of Palestine in January of 1914.
But so, what about conversations that you document between Lawrence and other people?
Yeah, I'm actually kind of a stickler on that. I don't recreate conversations unless I have it, unless it's documented. So any conversations I recount in my book are right from either from Lawrence's writings or from official government reports, or from, in the case of William Yale, from his memoirs. Mm-hmm. I kind of a stickler for that. So,
what about you, Vicky?
Same thing. I would any conversations were from diaries. I would complain.
People kept pretty good diaries then, I guess.
Thank God. It's pre-email. But I also have gone down the rabbit hole for weather records for both books. It's incredible. And I was looking up a specific night in Hong Kong for my last book, and there's only one Chinese, English language Chinese newspaper that carried the weather report, and I went to Chicago and got my hands on the microfilm for that record, and that they were missing that day. But I did end up through Hong Kong getting it. But everyone who writes nonfiction, historical nonfiction, weather records are but it's very important to be accurate. And so I don't have any dialogue that he didn't report himself, and I think even finding a cigarette brand, you get very obsessive when you're writing nonfiction about finding any little detail like that.
I agree. I feel the same way. I mean, everything is from archives or somebody said it, with the exception of the two first chapters of my book are very short, and there is some speculation in them, though that speculation is built on I got the title charts, everything. I mean, a lot of, on all these records on how the Azmat, I wasn't present as the Azmat. I mean, nobody was butchered and did what they did to Michael Rockefeller. But everything they did, for instance, was according to very sacred rules and regulation, adat, you know, ceremony, ritual, and those were detailed in anthropological journals. And I say in, you know, the beginning of chapter three, I have these sort of two scenes where I set it up, and then I say, this is my little shift. It's the only way I could do it. And I had to do it in the very beginning to sort of get that over with. And then I say on the beginning of chapter three, you know, wave hit the boat, took me out of my reverie as I imagined and wondered if that was how Michael had died. And then I spend the rest of the book trying to prove that. But, you know, for me, one of the most fascinating things was the thing I did first was this archival work. And so I had all of these reports that were over 50 years old that were from these Dutch archives. And then I eventually went to Azmat. And I originally did not tell my translator and my boat guy. I didn't say anything about Michael Rockefeller. I didn't say this is what I was. I just said I was a journalist. I was interested in Azmat culture. And I wanted to sort of wander around some of the villages and the rivers at first. And one day we arrived at a village, and it was a little bigger village, had a school and it had a store, and there were no hotels. We often stayed in the schoolmaster's house because he was sort of the big guy. And there was no furniture in any of these houses. We were sitting on the floor one evening, and an older man came in, and he had wild hair and a hole through his septum, and he smelled like smoke and bare feet, and Amatis, my translator, was very reverential to him and called him Bapa, you know, father. And he said, oh, this is Kokai. Kokai eventually figures largely in my book and says, this is Kokai. He's like the headman of Ochinap, the Pirien. And he's here because he's got a new wife from here. And so then I said to him, well, there was this whole backstory of Michael Rockefeller based on a raid that had happened earlier. And I said, well, does he remember any sort of Dutch raid? And I said, how old is he? And they talked. And he said, well, he doesn't know, but he thinks he's in his 60s. And I said, well, does he remember a Dutch raid in the 1950s? And they talked a while. And then the thing about the Azmat is that there are no records. You know, there's no archives. There's no written language. So there's no, you know, there was no equivalent to the Dutch records. But the Azmat in this world have incredible memories. They remember everything. And they're amazing storytellers. You know, if you want to hear a story, you have to tell a story. If you want to hear music, you have to play music. So Kokai starts telling this story, and he's like, boom, and boom, the head blowing up. And he's got a spear and everything. And I hear these names, you know, Akun, Samut, Ipi, Awesome. And I knew those names I didn't speak the language in those days at that point, but I heard those names, and those were the same names that were in the Dutch reports from 50 years ago. And that was the beginning of these two worlds coming together, the world in the archives and the world in the Azmat. And that was the whole book is really based on trying to verify those two things. But at that moment, I was just my heart was beating because what was described in these 50-year-old Dutch English or Dutch archives was being verified. You know, there were no leading questions or anything. It was just this guy telling the same story, and that's when I knew it was real, and that I was really on the track of something.
The word that comes up in your book over and over again is headhunting, which, as somebody who used to report on Wall Street, I thought of that originally as something a little bit different. But do you think that it still goes on in that culture today?
No. The AzMat are, beginning in 1955, 1956, were pacified by the Dutch, and there was a heavy Catholic missionary presence. And I think there was some at the time of Michael's 1960, 61, there was still widespread headhunting and cannibalism. But I think by then Indonesia took over in 1962, was very, the Indonesians burned all the longhouses and forbid all carving and feasting. They were very heavy-handed. I mean, much more heavy-handed even than the Dutch were. And, there was probably in pockets, there were reports into the 70s and 80s, but no longer. The AzMat today are Catholics with three wives and spirits in the sago, you know.
Vicky, we learn all about how brilliant elephants are in this book. What is the state of them today?
It's terrible, actually, and particularly for Asian elephants, which I write about in Elephant Company. They're being slaughtered at unprecedented rates, mostly for the Chinese market medicine and carving the ivory. And so it's
ivory
tough.
Is still an issue now.
It is. You know, I remind people because we wag our finger at other countries, and we in the U.S. used to be, and we're still, I think, the second largest consumer of poached ivory right now. But in the 1950s and 60s, when our middle class could suddenly afford piano lessons for their daughters generally, and piano keys were made of ivory at that time, and we drove another slaughter of elephants. That's largely African elephants that this is happening to. Asian elephants, only the males have tusks. And they're smaller than the African, so they're not getting as much of that as African elephants. But still, the population has been really reduced. And I, myself, am interested in Burma in particular. It has the second largest population of Asian elephants in the world. That's after India. And what everyone's wondering about is Myanmar opens up to international business. What will happen to the elephants? And believe it or not, when I say to people, in India, one of the biggest problems is unemployed elephants. Elephants that have been captive and working suddenly don't have work anymore because machines have taken their place. And they're actually on the street with their mahouts begging for food and money. And conservationists are worried about what's going to happen in Myanmar today as big international corporations come in and bring heavy equipment. And counterintuitively, logging business has actually helped the population of elephants in Myanmar. And so everyone worries what's about to happen there. And a lot of people who are working very hard on elephant conservation are coming into the country now.
Scott, your book has a lot of places that are in the news right now. I'm thinking specifically of Aleppo, right, which Lawrence goes to. What is what you have, and I know people have asked you this because you've been brought on shows to talk about this, but what has what you've learned about the creation of the modern Middle East told you about what's going on there right now?
Yeah, I think what we're, I probably wouldn't have said this 2 years ago, but in just seeing the disintegration that's taking place throughout the region in Syria and in Libya, Iraq, It appears that what's happening is that the whole region is reverting back to the borders that existed before the Europeans came in and created artificial borders, back before World War I. Under the Ottoman Empire, which almost the entire Middle East was controlled by the Ottomans, Iraq was three autonomous regions. It was Shia, Sunni, and Kurd. And Iraq today is dividing up along those same lines. Libya was three autonomous regions. Today, Libya is essentially three countries. And so I think you can just see that it's spreading throughout the region. A couple of months ago, I was actually went to Carchemish, which is where Lawrence spent 5 years before the war as an archaeologist. And Carchemish actually sits exactly on the border of modern-day Turkey and Syria. And it's on a little bluff where there's this Hittite region on top of the bluff, and you could literally throw a rock into Syria. And the creepiest, this was just before ISIS really started going crazy in Syria and Iraq, but right right on the border, there's a three-story building, there's a wall, and there's the ISIS flag right there. The ISIS controls that whole area of northern Syria. So I think that we're just in for a really long, kind of sad period where things are just going to get worse and worse.
What about the idea, though, of relying on local populations to fight the fight of Western governments? I was just interviewing Rajiv Chandrasekharan of the Washington Post the other day, who has done this reporting about the people that the U.S. is training to fight in Syria. And in fact, I didn't realize this, what they're doing is not going and arming the people in Syria. They're going to the refugee camps in Jordan and trying to recruit Syrians to go back in and fight against ISIS in Syria. But it does look like, in some ways, Lawrence had some success in getting right. people to do what he wanted.
No, he did. I think everybody recognizes what you need is you need to empower the... Lawrence understood the clan and tribal structure of Arab society, which is something that no one did at the time, and no one seems to have learned it in 100 years on. People who knew Iraq, for instance, in the run-up to the American invasion in 2003, there were people who knew Iraq who warned the administration. It's like, this is a much more complex culture than you can imagine, and it's beyond the three ethnic groups. You're talking about clans and tribes and sub-clans. And in typical American fashion, it was just blithely ignored, and then all hell broke loose. And we're still trying to pick up the pieces from that today. Also true in Syria. Also true throughout the region. So yes, the only way forward is you have to go and empower these different groups and win some of them over to your cause.
I want to ask you each one more question. Then, if people have questions, we'd love to hear some of them. But what? And I'll start with you, Carl. What did you learn about Michael Rockefeller or the Azmat, I guess, that you in doing this book that you've taken and you can use in your own life and how you act? Or did you learn anything about their character that you have?
Well, I think the biggest thing is that it reaffirmed the need to go slowly sometimes as a reporter and a writer, and to go as deeply as you can, and to spend the time with people, and you can get sucked into deadlines and trying to make money and trying to pay the bills and sort of saying, oh, I'll do something really fast, and that's never a very good idea. It's always better, and that's what really came home in this story, and that I had to make two trips back into Azmat, and the second one I had to do completely differently than the first one, and I had to go so far as to learn a language and go and live with these people and leave everything sort of behind for a while, and that just reaffirms how important that is to do when you're really trying to understand something and understand a culture that's very different from your own.
Vicky?
I learned about trust from J.H. Williams, and I was intrigued that he talked about elephants and trust, and that he parsed trust, not just as, you don't trust someone just because they're nice. You trust them because you can count on them. They have backbone. They're going to be there for you. And he talked about the way he earned an elephant's trust by always being someone that they could count on, and I had never thought of it before. I had never thought about trust in that way. You just think someone's nice or they're nice to you. But that trust is a more complicated concept. And I learned more about human emotion through him and the elephants than I would have imagined.
Did you become more trusting or less trusting?
Unfortunately, more.
Always a dangerous thing. Scott, what about you?
Probably endurance. Lawrence's first introduction to the Middle East was he was at Oxford, and he was studying to do his senior thesis, and he was studying medieval military history, and he decided that he was going to go to Syria and do a study on the Crusader castles, and he was going to do it alone on foot during the summer break from Oxford when it can be 125 degrees in the Syrian interior. And everybody told him he was mad. and that he would die. And yet he went. He was 21 years old.
And they thought that he would die because what? Because of the physical conditions or because somebody would kill him?
Both. Okay. One or the other was going to kill him. There was no question. And yet he walked 1,200 miles across Syria at the age of 21. But also being 5'4", people thought he was like a 14-year-old kid, like wandering in off the desert. So I think what I mostly took from Lawrence on a personal level was just this incredible iron will and this ability to endure anything, and how with that power, somebody like him, can make their own way in the world and have a huge effect.
Great. I want to open it up if there are any questions from the audience. If you want to raise your hand, and we've got a mic over here. If you want to come up to the mic, actually. Somebody has to have a question. Yes. Why don't you come right over.
I'm interested in why the Rockefeller story was suppressed in the way it was. We had the recent story of Philomena, the Catholic Church in Ireland suppressing a lot of truth around that. And so I'm curious as to, I can imagine some of the reasons that it was suppressed, but you say that the truth was known within 3 weeks, and why was it suppressed for so long?
I don't know if everybody heard the question. It was just really why was the story of Michael Rock, what happened to Michael Rockefeller, suppressed? The answer is that some incredible timing. It's always comes down to timing. Joseph Luns, who was the Dutch Minister of Foreign Affairs, was actually making his Luns proposal to the United Nations General Assembly the very week Michael disappeared, and that was a proposal to essentially retain Papua. It was all of Indonesia. The Indonesian archipelago had been a Dutch colony, and that was everything was Indonesia became independent in 1949, and except with the exception of the western half of the island of New Guinea, and Sukarno became president, and he was a nationalist, and he was vacillating between the west and the east, and Kennedy broke with the Dutch and the British and the Australians and said, let's give Papua back to, just give it to Sukarno and as a carrot to keep him in the west, and the Dutch were rabidly against that and were proposing to the UN to sort of make it a protectorate for 10 years and then it would become an independent country, sympathetic to Dutch interests. And that was all predicated on this idea that Papua was this nation in the making and that there was this educated elite that was capable of leading a country and, not just a country full of headhunters and cannibals. And at the same, and that the church, of course, was hand in glove with the government, and the church was also proselytizing and never, the church doesn't like to have anything get in the way of proselytizing. So, going in and arresting people. The Dutch government went so far as to send an investigator, a colonial police officer, to live in the village for 3 months, which he did, and he came out convinced that Michael had been killed by the village. And all that was, that was incredibly disruptive to the Dutch plan. And, I think had there been a body, they would have done something. But without a body, it was just easier for everybody just not to get involved. And, it's amazing to see the documents from the Dutch government saying that the disappearance of Michael Rockefeller is the best thing to happen to Dutch New Guinea and to the Dutch proposal, and let's make political hay out of this now that Nelson is going to New Guinea. It's remarkable to see.
Yes, you, sir.
Has Ebola impacted any of the people that you wrote about in New Guinea?
There's no Ebola in New Guinea.
I thought there was in New Guinea.
There's Ebola in three West African countries, as far as I know, only. And then a few American cities.
New York, yes.
Hi, this is for Carl as well. I haven't read the book, but I listened to your Fresh Air interview, which was terrific. And what I remember...
He's going to be on Here and Now next week.
Okay. And what I remember is you talk about Michael abandoning the other person who was in the ocean with him and... going to the shore and probably being killed there. And I remember you saying he should never have done that, which led me to believe that Michael Rockefeller may have been naive, may have been self-absorbed? What was he like as a person?
Well, that's a good question. I mean, in some ways, he remains a bit of a cipher in the book. I think for two reasons. One, he was only 23. He was so young. And number two, I did not have access to the Rockefeller family. Nobody cooperated from the family. So while I was able to find most of his journals and the various letters, both to the Museum of Primitive Art, for whom he was collecting, and he was also a trustee of the museum, as well as to various priests that he was trying to meet who actually become important players later, as well as his good friend. I mean, the picture of him as a three-dimensional person is a little bit thinner than I would have liked. I also did find people who had, and you know, his tent mate, for instance, in the Highlands, but it's a little bit thin. You know, I think that he was all the things you mentioned. I mean, I think he was a good guy, probably, and he was really serious, and he was taking what he did seriously, and there are a lot of things he could have done that would have been a lot easier to do, I mean, than going to Asmat, which is like a really hard place to go to now, let alone 50 years ago. But at the same time, he was 23 years old. He was from a family and been raised sort of in a bubble and, in a world in which everything he wanted, he got. And that is reflected in, the memories of people. The guy who bought the boat that he overturned in is still alive and said, he was a nice enough guy, but he was insistent. He kept saying he wanted this big engine on the boat, and I kept telling him he didn't need that big an engine, and he got this big engine flown in. And it's obvious in the way that he traveled and the way that he traded and in his notes that he went very, very fast. He spent a lot of money quickly. He was able to do things because he had money that I wouldn't have been able to do. I would have had to spend more time and rely more on, contacts and making contacts and digging deeper. And I think all of those things eventually. And then ultimately, he jumped off the boat and he swam to shore, which was just purely, an impetuous thing to do and the kind of thing that a 23-year-old would do.
I want to remind everybody that these three are going to be signing some books back there in just a minute. If we have 30 seconds, I want to bring this last final question, but make it quick.
Sure. My question is, how do you know your research is complete?
I didn't hear the question.
Can you repeat that?
How do you know that your research is complete?
Is complete?
In other words, like you can, you can research a topic infinitely. At one point do you say, okay, I've got enough information?
I mean, one of you guys want to answer that? You can. I mean, I will too, but.
You know when your editor calls you and says, stop.
Right. Now, I mean, in my case, the original idea for my book was that it's 500 and some odd pages, and I was going to also talk about the Paris Peace Conference and the post-war period, and my editor said, no, you're not. You're done. So.
Well, thank you all so much, and thank you for coming.
Thank you.